Hello, you're listening to the Lowell Association for the Blind radio reading. Lowell Association for the Blind Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. It's your main source of accessible community news and information. We're located in Lowell, Massachusetts. We read local news, editorials, feature stories, and more. Lowell Association for the Blind Radio is brought to you by volunteers and staff of the Lowell Association for the Blind. I'm Leslie. I'll be reading to you today from the Tewksbury Town Crier. Lowell Association for the Blind would like to thank the Nancy and Richard Donahue Charitable Foundation for their support. The lead story today is telling us, Select Board Debates New Town Council Policy. The article is by Rosalind Impink in Tewksbury. The Tewksbury Select Board met early last month to discuss its new town council policy and review how town staff and boards and committees access legal advice. Town manager John Curran opened discussion by presenting a draft policy modeled on practices used in other communities and recommended by the State of Massachusetts Municipal Association. The goal, he said, was to ensure that all legal opinions are tracked, avoid conflicting requests, and prevent unnecessary billing. Under his proposal, department heads would route legal questions through his office, while boards and committees would make requests through their chairs, with exceptions for personal conflict of interest issues. Curran emphasized that the policy was not intended to restrict access, but to prevent situations where multiple officials unknowingly seek advice on the same issue or pursue contradictory guidance, which has caused challenges in other towns. Town council found themselves in the middle of a whole bunch of conflicts they shouldn't be in, he cautioned, noting that council represents the town as a whole, not individual opinions. Select board member John Lombardo questioned why the policy was needed now and whether other boards, such as the Board of Health or Zoning Board of Appeals, had been consulted. Curran acknowledged they had not, noting the request originated from the select board. Member Mark Kreitman, who raised the issue of a prior meeting, reiterated his concerns about cost and transparency. Without a policy, he argued, multiple board members could unknowingly ask the same legal question, generating duplicate charges, adding that legal opinions should be shared through the town manager's weekly reports. But member James Mackey strongly objected to the draft, calling it overly restrictive and inconsistent with the select board's authority. He argued that the board members should not need permission to consult the attorney they appoint. We are not attorneys, he said. Council is our resource for a reason. We should have access to that resource equally. Mackey presented an alternative policy that preserves direct access for select board members, allows other boards to coordinate requests through the town manager, and emphasizes courtesy rather than gatekeeping. The exchange prompted a broader discussion about board autonomy, minority opinions rights, and the potential for unintended consequences. Member Rich Russo expressed concern that a restrictive policy could prevent a board member from seeking legal clarity if they believed their board was acting improperly. Curran countered that such disputes should be resolved within the board, not through competing legal requests. Chair Eric Ryder urged caution, noting that many communities do have formal policies, but that the board should not rush a vote. I don't feel like I can vote on this right now, he said, calling for time to review both versions. With no consensus, the board agreed to table the matter for a future meeting and ask the town manager to further refine the policy based on the discussion. Also on the front page, the Select Board reviews potential housing monitoring proposal. The article is by Rosalind Impink in Tewksbury. The Tewksbury Select Board met early last month with all members present. The board revised applications and made appointments to various boards and committees and approved a road race application for Into Action Recovery in September. The board reviewed a proposal that may help the town establish consistent oversight for its affordable housing inventory. Town Manager John Curran outlined an order from NMCOG, North Middlesex Council of Governments, to provide regional monitoring services for communities seeking to preserve their existing subsidized units. Tewksbury currently has 1,266 units on the subsidized housing inventory, and only 147 of those, 127 affordable ownership units and 20 affordable rentals, fall under the town direct responsibility for income verification and resale compliance. Others are managed by different state authorities. Without a formal monitoring system, Curran warned, the town risks slow, painful loss of units, especially when affordable homes go on the market and eligible buyers cannot be found. In those cases, units may convert to market rate, pushing Tewksbury below the 10% affordable housing threshold required under Chapter 40B. Under NMCOG, model participating towns, including Lowell and Westford, would share a flat annual fee funded locally through the Affordable Housing Trust for the first year and later through Community Preservation Act funds. Board members expressed support for a one-year pilot, but raised concerns about cost equity given Lowell's larger housing stock. Members also asked that the housing authority be consulted before any vote. Curran will return at the next meeting with legal guidance, cost details, and feedback from housing officials. Curran provided several updates in his report. The town will be offering an open meeting law and public records training for board and committee members on June 24th, following several open meeting law complaints filed against the board. The board voted to post the vacant school committee seat to solicit applicants for 2 weeks. Two site visits have been conducted at the Trahan School ahead of the redevelopment project, including a historic review that could unlock tax credits. Curran also reported, Director of Guidance Services James Carlson presented an overview of post-secondary outcomes for the class of 2026 and described the school's comprehension guidance curriculum. According to Carlson, approximately one-third of graduates entered the workforce directly. Enrollment in two-year colleges increased, a trend attributed in part to Massachusetts' expanded free community college opportunities. Four-year college attendance remained stable, and military enlistment and apprenticeship participation also remained consistent. Carlson noted that construction management programs have become increasingly popular among graduates, reflecting strong opportunities within the skills trade industry. McIntosh reported that the district graduated 297 seniors earlier this month. Next year's senior class is expected to be smaller, with approximately 286 students. The cooperative education program for the class of 2026 had 200 seniors participate in co-op placements, representing students working 116,962 hours and earning nearly $1.89 million in gross wages. placements involved 159 local employers. Many graduates have accepted full-time employment offers from their co-op employers, according to McIntosh. Committee members also recognized William Track of Wilmington, a masonry student who earned a bronze medal at the National Skills USA competition. It was believed to be the first national masonry medal won by a Massachusetts competitor in more than two decades. The committee reviewed a revised fiscal year 2027 budget proposal that reduces spending by approximately $435,000 from earlier versions. Most of the reduction came from capital spending adjustments, delayed projects, professional development reductions, and supply budget cuts. Since communities have not yet completed the necessary approval process, the district will operate under a temporary 1/12th budget mechanism beginning July 1st. This allows monthly expenditures while the fiscal budget process continues. McIntosh said the final community action is expected to occur during fall town meetings. Three communities had rejected the Shawsheen budget during their town meeting process. The committee also reviewed recommendations to return $558,403,000 excess and deficiency funds to member communities. District officials said the reimbursements would ultimately be applied against community assessments once the fiscal year 2027 budget is finalized. Members discussed using this as an enticement to get sending towns to approve the budget. Committee members also discussed the district's external audit contract. CBIZ is the current auditor, and the committee is not entirely pleased with the firm's responsiveness. However, CBIZ returned the only fully responsive proposal through the bidding process, prompting discussions about whether to proceed immediately or continue exploring alternatives. Committee members indicated additional conversations may occur over the summer before a recommendation is brought forward. We're told the Planning Board receives home build update. The article is by Rosalind Impink in Tewksbury. The Tewksbury Planning Board met on June 15th with all members present. Town Planner Alex Lauder highlighted several upcoming summer events, including summer, the town's last day of school celebration in June 18th. The Tewksbury Community Market will be held at Livingston Street Park behind the Recreation Center on Thursdays throughout the summer from 4 to 7 p.m. A variety of vendors will be offering prepared foods, handcrafts, and fresh produce. Visit www.tewksburymarket.com for vendor lists and dates. The board confirmed a special permit and site plan review for 60 Woburn Street to the next meeting at the request of the applicant, and a special permit application for MVP 2087 Main Street was requested to be withdrawn by the applicant. The board reviewed a special permit request from Lowell 5 Bank to replace its aging, non-conforming pylon sign with a smaller, monumental version. Representative Jason Perillo explained that the new sign would sit closer to the bank's primary driveway, improving visibility and reducing confusion with the adjacent restaurant entrance. The proposal required waivers for the height, 83 inches instead of the allowed 72, and for a reduced setback within the narrow grassy median. Board members largely praised the design as a significant improvement through concerns, though concerns surfaced about its proximity to the sidewalk and potential winter plow damage. They're taking a risk, Chair Steve Johnson noted, citing conditions requiring the sign to be kept clean, repaired promptly, and maintained in perpetuity. With those stipulations, the board voted unanimously to approve the special permit. Member Vinnie Fratalia provided an update on the Tewksbury Home Bill's reconstruction of 97 Florence Avenue. The town-owned property had sat vacant for 14 years before being transferred to the nonprofit, which partnered with Shawshin Tech students and several local contractors to rebuild the home from the ground up. The Tewksbury Housing Authority held a first-time homebuyer lottery for qualifying applicants, and a family will be moving in this summer. Fratalia credited dozens of volunteers and donors, many from Tewksbury, for turning a blighted structure into a welcoming home. It takes a village, he said, with board members applauding the collaboration effort. The next meeting is scheduled for July 13th. Watch full meeting online at www.youtube.com/TewksburyTV and review current applications at www.tewksbury-ma.gov/530/active-planning-board-application. And here we have good news. Shawshin discusses finances and celebrates student success. In Billerica, the Shawshin Tech School Committee met June 16th, addressing ongoing financial reconciliation efforts, reviewing enrollment trends, celebrating student and athletic achievements, and discussing the district's fiscal year 2027 budget. Representatives from Clifton Allen, a CPA firm specializing in Massachusetts municipal finance, outlined a proposal to assist the district with reconciling its cash records and establishing stronger financial controls moving forward. The consultants explained that Massachusetts municipalities and school districts are required to maintain a three-way reconciliation process involving bank accounts, the treasurer's cash book, and the district's general ledger. Initial work would focus on the previous two fiscal years where the target variances have been identified. The committee voted to authorize Superintendent Tony McIntosh to move forward with a service agreement for the reconciliation work. Athletic Director Al Constable presented an enthusiastic year-end report highlighting one of the most successful athletic seasons in school history. Among the accomplishments were the boys' lacrosse team finishing 21-1, capturing the Commonwealth Athletic Conference Championship and the State Vocational Championship. Girls' title with 11-6 record, baseball finished 17-4, earning both league and state vocational championships. Boys tennis completed the season with a 10-0 and captured the CAC title. Several student athletes reached major milestones, including Josh Baker scoring his 100th career lacrosse goal, while Sarah Salter recorded her 100th career goal for the girls' lacrosse program. Track standout Hattie Sebe broke school records in both the 400-meter dash and the 400-meter hurdles, qualifying her for the Medal of Champions and advancing to the New England Championships. Constable also said 23 student-athletes committed to continue their athletic careers at the collegiate level, far surpassing previous years. And here in the Middlesex East area, we're told local cities and towns are making strides in funding OPEB obligations. The article is by Patrick Blaise. With Wakefield leading the pack by already banking more than a third of its estimated $91.64 liability for of 8 communities in the Middlesex East's coverage area have set aside at least 10% of the funds needed to cover their cumulative $1 billion in so-called other pre-employment benefits or OPEB debts. Once an ugly financial secret buried deep in town and city halls across the state, the OPEB issue has become a front and center topic of conversation now that the rating agencies like Moody's Investors Service and Standard & Poor Global Ratings have begun inquiring about whether communities have begun addressing the debt. For example, back in 2021, when S&P Global labeled Stoneham with a AA+ bond rating before the town went out to borrow some $217 million for a new high school, local officials, when inquiring about how the town could bump that second highest classification up to the highest AAA rating, were advised to get more serious about its OPEB obligations. Stoneham officials, who at the time of the ratings report had just agreed to begin depositing $50,000 each year into a special OPEB trust fund, has, despite serious financial difficulties in recent years, followed that advice and increased the annual contributions to $200,000. However, according to the latest statewide OPEB assessment, which was released this past May by the Public Employee Retirement Administration Commission, Stoneham has set aside less than 1% of the total funding needed to cover its obligations to current and future retirees. In fact, based on the 16-page report, which was prepared by consultants from 15 actuarial firms, Stoneham's OPEB savings are so abysmal that the town is considered as having a 0% funded ratio. On the opposite side of the OPEB picture is Wakefield, which, according to the PERAC report, has amassed nearly 36.6% of the $91.6 million it needs to fully fund its liability. Below follows a synopsis of several Middlesex East Communities OPEB positions. In Woburn, which is in the summer of 2018, had already set aside $4 million to tackle its OPEB liabilities, has since that time been depositing $750,000 a year into its trust fund. However, the city also has the largest municipal workforce and active retiree pools in the Middlesex East region, and as a result, has the largest estimated OPEB liability as $233.3 million. As of last May, the city had accumulated $15.5 million in assets in its trust fund, which is equivalent to a funded ratio of 6.7%. In Tewksbury, where town officials established an OPEB trust fund in 2014 and crafted an informal plan to cover its liabilities by 2055, the town's OPEB obligations also climbed from a 2021 estimate of $81.7 million to $120.8 million, which makes an annual OPEB contribution of at least $650,000 a year, has accumulated $10.77 million in its trust fund for a funded ratio of 6.95%. Wilmington, where the community set up a special fund way back in 2015 and began depositing $1 million into it annually to address its OPEB debt. The town's OPEB liability actually climbed from $104 million in 2021 to a most recently estimated $137 million. As of May 2026, the community had amassed roughly $16.6 million in trust fund assessments, a funded ratio of 12%. Not to be confused with unfunded pension systems, obligations which relate to the money needed to cover retirees' monthly living stipends. OPEB deals strictly with state and municipal officials' failure to set aside the necessary funding to cover future retiree benefits like medical, dental, disability, and life insurance plans. Back in 2001, Government Accountability Standards Board, fully aware that most retirement systems were not saving any money to cover their share of health insurance premiums and other benefits promised to employees after their careers ended, directed all municipalities and state agencies to begin the process of calculating the size of those liabilities. With the mandate requiring many cities and towns to completely overhaul their entire accounting system structures, those initial estimates ultimately were not released until 2014. However, with workers continually flowing in and out of the system, and investment returns further shrinking, the debts over time, the size of the liability for each local, regional, and state retirement system is in constant flux. For example, back in 2016, when PERLAC released its first comprehensive report on OPEB obligations, the state OPEB liability was pegged at $16.7 billion, while municipal retirement systems were estimated to owe an additional $30 billion. 5 years later, in a follow-up report, PERLAC suggested that the state's cumulative OPEB liability, which had in 2016 been estimated at around $46 billion, had grown to $56 billion. As a whole, municipal and state officials in 2021 had set aside just shy of 6% of the money needed to cover their pledges to retirees. However, based on the latest May of 2026 analysis, that picture has changed dramatically, as local officials have gotten much more serious about addressing what one former Woburn official described as the 800-pound gorilla in the room that no one wanted to talk about. Specifically, those who authorized the OPEB update estimated state agencies in Massachusetts have now funded just over 18% of its $15 billion liability, while some 300 cities and towns across the state has shaved some $3 billion off their estimated $30 billion in obligations. A little more than one half of these cities and towns have funded ration of less than 10%. More than one-third cities and towns have a funded ratio between 10 and 50%, and three plans have a funded ratio in excess of 100%, per the report concluded. Most towns have indicated that a trust has been established to fund OPEB benefits. Less than 10 towns indicated no trust has been established. The PERLAC consultants continued, "For another 40 or 50 towns, we could not find an indication in the report as to whether an OPEB trust has been established. Technically, no municipality or state agency is currently required to do anything in regards to their OPEB liabilities other than keep up-to-date estimates of the debt estimates. Many local officials who have pointed out that taxpayers are already making sizable annual contributions to cover their pensions system liability contended that once these debts are paid off, they can reallocate that revenue stream towards OPEC matters. Based on a state mandate, all local, regional, and state retirement systems must fully fund their pension system obligations by 2040. We have a letter to the editor saying birthright citizenship amendment must change. And there's an author's note. This piece was submitted prior to the Supreme Court's scheduled ruling on birthright citizenship with the expectation that publication would occur immediately following the release of the decision. To the editor, while readers are now processing the practical impacts of the Supreme Court's major ruling on birthright citizenship, this commentary is being penned days before the justices take the bench. My prediction has long been clear, 7-2 decision in favor of upholding the traditional interpretation of automatic birthright citizenship. However, predicting a legal outcome based on current constitutional precedent is entirely different from agreeing with it. The reality is our current immigration landscape has evolved into something completely unrecognizable and intended by the framers of our laws. From the founding of our country until roughly the 1940s, immigration required an immense, often life-threatening commitment. To reach the New World, individuals had to board wooden ships, risk disease, and put their families through extreme peril for a chance at a new life. Because of that high barrier, and because a growing nation desperately needed to build a massive standing army to defend its borders and settle a vast continent, the government welcomed nearly everyone who survived the journey. That all changed in the post-World War II era. Once transatlantic aviation replaced the perilous ocean voyage, immigration transformed from a high-risk pilgrimage into a logical calculation. Today, wealthy leaders from all over the globe, particularly from nations like China, exploit the modern ease of travel. Expectant mothers can simply board a commercial airliner, land in the United States, and automatically secure full citizenship for their newborn children. This birth tourism guarantees their offspring permanent access to the finest healthcare and best higher education systems in the world, with zero foundational ties or generational investment in our communities. This brings us to the two modern forces keeping this incentive structure alive. Corporate demand for cheap labor. Since 1950, the corporate elite and the wealthy have tolerated, if not welcomed, illegal immigration because it provides a continuous supply of low-cost labor, driving down operational expenses and reducing the obligation to provide meaningful benefits. And federal dependency. On the other side of the aisle, the political establishment, specifically the Democratic Party, seems to expand public assistance programs, keeping people on the dole to foster a permanent reliance on the state, securing a reliable voting bloc rather than encouraging a return to the dignity of work and self-sufficiency. The framers of our Constitution would never have imagined a world of commercial flight where citizenship could be acquired through a brief travel itinerary. It is time to acknowledge that the rules of the 19th century do not fit the exploitation of the 21st. This article is sent to the editor by George Ferdinand of Tewksbury. You have been listening to the Lowell Association for the Blind radio reading. Lowell Association for the Blind would like to thank UMass Lowell's WUML-FM for providing the radio signal that allows us to broadcast 5 days a week. Thank you for listening to Lowell Association for the Blind. Lowell Association for the Blind Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. There are many ways to listen to Lowell Association for the Blind Radio. You may request a free specialized radio receiver. Or for more information about our radio reading service, you may call Lowell Association for the Blind at 978-454-5704. And you can listen to Lowell Association for the Blind Radio anytime by dialing 1-631-359-9069. And you may visit our website, where you can tune in to Lowell Association for the Blind Radio at lowellassociationfortheblind.org. This has been Leslie. Thank you for listening, and enjoy your day.